Okay, before I begin the actual lecture today, any of you have any questions about the course? Is everything going okay in terms of, yeah?
So there's a reading on the website under week two, are supposed to
read it? Voluntary, okay. Right? The only things you're required to read are the things that are labeled as such in the syllabus.
Okay.
And occasionally you have people who are kind of interested in going into greater detail, especially in seeing what I myself think. So I put that stuff there. As a matter of fact, that article that I wrote on Versailles, I'm going to be reading some of the key passages from it in class today. But did you?
Oh, well, I was just going to ask the same question.
But in terms of getting the readings and so on, everything is working smoothly? Great. Does anyone have any questions about the substance of the course and any of the things I've talked about so far? Did you have? Oh, okay. You remember how I ended the lecture last time with that question? Right. To everyone's surprise, in a sense, the First World War ended with neither the victory of Germany nor with the victory of a coalition in which one of the key members was Tsarist Russia. In fact, both Germany and Russia were defeated. And the war was won by the Western powers only because the United States of America intervened in the war, by far the strongest country in the world in terms of mobilizable war potential, given the military technology of that period, which is based on heavy industry, steel production, things like that. All right? What this meant was that the three Western powers, the three Western democracies, the United States, Britain, and France, were able to dictate the terms of peace, to impose the peace terms. Right. Say, well, it wasn't supposed to be quite an imposed peace. There was supposed to be a negotiation based on the principles that Wilson had laid down in his wartime addresses, those speeches that you read. The Germans laid down their arms before German territory was actually even invaded. I mean, they knew that the war, there was no way that they could win the war. They wanted to end the conflict before German territory itself was devastated. But the First World War was not ended by an unconditional surrender. As a matter of fact, one of the big reasons why the unconditional surrender policy was adopted during the Second World War is that that policy had not been used in the First World War, and that led to all kinds of problems. Okay? There was an agreement called the Pre-Armistice Agreement that the Germans had entered into with the Western powers, according to which they would lay down their arms, they would allow the Allies to occupy part of German territory, the left bank of the Rhine River, this whole area here, plus these three bridgeheads on the right bank of the Rhine, which would enable them, if they had to resume the war against Germany. There would be no way in which the Germans could resist the combined power of the three great victor powers in the war. But in exchange for that, the Germans were promised that the peace would be based on the Wilsonian program, the program that President Wilson had laid down in his wartime speeches, 14-point speech and all these other speeches that he had given, with these two big exceptions. One had to do with freedom of the seas, and this other had to do with reparations. Freedom of the seas, why was this important? Because that was the issue that the United States had supposedly entered the war over in 1917, that the German submarine war was a violation of the principle of freedom of the seas. But freedom of the seas meant that, you can trade with anyone you wanted with the exception of these kind of narrow categories of contraband of war. And that would, in an age when a war was based on the mobilization of the energies and the resources of entire nations, naval power was effective only if It was used in support of a blockade, a very broad blockade, that tried to kind of starve out enemy powers. And what have a navy if you can't have blockade? And yet the navy was the principal instrument of British power, so the British kind of resisted this, and the Americans did not insist. All right, so freedom of the seas, that goes out the window. The other issue that was an exception to this general principle that the peace would be based on the Wilsonian program had to do with reparations. And there were various provisions in the Wilson program, the 14 points, that called for Germany to restore the devastated areas. And the pre-armistice agreement said, well, there should be no doubt about what these provisions meant. Germany was to make compensation for all the damage caused by the aggression of Germany by land, sea, and air. And the clear understanding was that this would refer to material devastation, the damage that had been caused by the war, rather than all kinds of indirect things like the financial cost to Britain and America of fighting the war, the pensions you would pay to soldiers that had been disabled by the war, or to their survivors if they had been killed in the war. It was supposed to be a kind of a narrow thing. Just look at the terms of the 14 points and the pre-armistice agreement, you can see that that's the case. Right? So the Germans were made certain promises. And part of the case that they made against the Versailles Peace and the justification that they claimed for resisting compliance with the Versailles Peace in the interwar period was that the Allies had reneged on those promises. The Western powers had promised that peace would be made on the basis of the Wilson program, and then the actual Treaty of Versailles was very different from that. All right, so these are like historical arguments that had enormous political salience at the time. People really cared about this stuff. Okay. But in physical terms, in terms of a raw power, the three Western democracies held all the cards. Okay? They had the physical ability to impose a peace on Germany because they basically had the knife right at Germany's throat. And there was no negotiation in 1919 between the Western powers and Germany. Instead, basically, the negotiation took place among the three Western powers. And then Germany was basically told to sign on the dotted line or else, right? And Versailles Peace, an imposed peace, you know, in some very real ways, a violation of certainly of the spirit and to a certain extent also of the letter of the pre-armistice agreement. Okay? This peace, like this way I ended the lecture last time, the only major peace in the history of great power politics to be dictated by democracies, by, in this case, by the three great Western democracies, and by them alone. That was not the case with the Vienna Peace that settled the Napoleonic Wars a century earlier. It was not to be the case in the Cold War settlement, the settlement that came into being after the Second World War, in which the Soviet Union, certainly not a democratic power, played a key role. Not the case in the peace settlements and great power politics before the French Revolution. Right? This was the only case of the democratic powers and them alone dictating the terms of peace. Okay? At the same time, this peace that they dictated, the Versailles Peace, the peace embodied in the Treaty of Versailles that was signed with Germany in June 1919. This Versailles Peace turned out to be the most unstable peace in the history of great power politics. Right? Just a decade later, this is before the Depression, before the Nazis came to power in Germany, just a decade later, by the end of the 1920s, the whole system was in shambles. You know, it was clear that the foundation for a stable international order had not been laid. And 2 decades later, in 1939, you have this new war with Germany breaking out, a more dangerous war, more horrible war. You know, by any reckoning, the peace of 1919 was was an enormous failure. You can't say that about the Vienna settlement after the Napoleonic Wars. You can't say that about the Cold War settlement, which continues to provide the basis of the current international order. Relatively stable. No one's afraid of a new great power war today. And the question for you, and this is the question that I ended the lecture on last time, whether there's any connection between those two facts. Between the fact that on the one hand, this was the only major peace to be dictated by the Western democracies and by them alone. And second fact, on the other hand, that this was by far the most unstable peace in the history of great power politics. Right? Now, why is that question important? It's important because it relates to some of the most fundamental issues that anyone who thinks seriously about international politics has to confront. Issues which, in fact, you're going to have to confront in this course, because these are the issues that the second part of the final exam, the take-home paper part of the final exam, is going to be based on. Let me turn this down slightly. This is the issue of how should foreign policy be conducted? Are there any general principles that should guide foreign policy? Are there any specific types of foreign policy that should be avoided and other types of foreign policy that should be adopted? Okay. And why is this issue serious? Because a lot of people who haven't studied these things, they just absorb these notions from the general culture. What sort of foreign policy should a country like the United States pursue? Well, a policy based on what's right, on moral principle. How could you dispute that? You know, on what's just. You know, shouldn't be concerned with, these kind of sordid things about what the power balance is and things like that. You should try and always do the right thing. And right thing, what does that mean? Well, we should promote democracy abroad. We should promote human rights, the rule of law, all those kinds of things that we associate with the concept of a democratic foreign policy. Most people think, those are the principles that should guide U.S. foreign policy today. Okay? Common view, a natural view. How could you argue with the view that a country should try and do what's right? Yeah. Well, people did argue with it. There's a whole conservative critique of that whole way of looking at these things. That's very powerful. Its importance lies in the fact that it's, to a certain degree, counterintuitive. It runs against these kind of simple notions that you absorb from the general culture about how a foreign policy should be conducted. Right. Where do you find these views laid out? Well, you saw it laid out in that lecture that you read by George Kennan. Gave, I think it was in 1950, that lecture. Trying to lay out what American policy should be, what policy in general should be, not just U.S. policy, that it shouldn't be based on these kind of Wilsonian principles, that it should think in parapolitical terms, that it shouldn't be so concerned with moral principle and with making judgments and so on, but with trying to construct a stable balance of power. It should understand the role that power necessarily plays in international politics, and that the stability of the system is necessarily a function of the distribution of power. Right? Now, Kennan wasn't the first person to make these arguments, you know. This is part and parcel of the conservative critique of democratic foreign policy since the age of the French Revolution. These arguments were made by the great British Foreign Minister, Lord Castlereagh, during the period of the Congress of Vienna, the period right after the Napoleonic Wars, and other leading conservative statesmen, like the greatest statesman of late 19th century Europe, Lord Salisbury, argued along very similar lines. So it's not like these notions are kind of emerging, fully clothed from Kennan's head and had no antecedent whatsoever. But Kennan laid them out in a very powerful way. And this is what's called the realist critique of U.S. foreign policy. And it's as though in the debates about these issues, you have these two great gangs that dominate the debate. They're the liberals who take a Wilsonian approach, who believe in democratic foreign policy and so on, extending democracy, rule of law, international institutions, League of Nations, United Nations, that whole cluster of ideas. And then the rival camp, the realists, they're called. And Kennan is certainly in that realist camp. And their argument is, no, you shouldn't pursue that sort of policy. It messes things up. It leads to all sorts of trouble. Okay? Now, your question is, how do you get a handle on that issue? How do you go about figuring out who's right? Right? Is it just a question to your visceral sense? I think of myself as a hard-headed person, so I'm going to be a realist. Or, I'm an idealistic person, so I'm going to go with the liberal camp. You owe it to yourself to go beyond that and to try and figure out whether there's some way of getting a handle on that set of notions so that you can see beyond the preconceptions that you take to the problem. And what is that way? Well, it's not going to surprise you, given what I've been saying about the whole idea of this course, is that, there's a way. And the way consists of bringing these general notions down to earth by translating them into kind of historical interpretations, by understanding how there are certain connections between these general theoretical arguments, abstract arguments, and the interpretation of concrete historical episodes. Right. And in this case, the whole question of the failure of the peace of 1919, this is a fundamental case in point for getting at those issues. Okay. You have this Wilsonian approach, realist approach. People of those two sets of orientations make different arguments about what happened after the First World War to support their views of international politics. Well, you saw in the case of Kennan, right? He's making not just an abstract argument about policy, he's making an argument about how America went wrong during the Wilson period. Why the Wilson approach was bad, why it led to instability, what a better approach would have been, and if they had adopted it, things probably would have been a whole lot better. Right? A realist like Kennan, he's going to pivot his argument around a particular interpretation of what happened after the First World War. The people in the Wilsonian camp are also going to make their argument about what happened. So these historical debates have a theoretical resonance. And by getting at the historical debates, you'll get some insight into these theoretical issues about what makes for good foreign policy. And what are the claims about the role that the Wilsonian policy played in the post-World War I period? Well, everyone knows the peace failed, but the Wilsonians said, it wasn't Wilson's fault. It was because he was defeated by these Europeans who may have had democratic political systems, but they didn't really buy into the whole notion of a democratic foreign policy. Britain and France, they were democracies, but they were also great imperial powers, so they were kind of half and half, and they couldn't really accept the fundamental transformation of the international system that Wilson wanted. The problem was not that the Wilson program was implemented, but rather that it was defeated, right? That's the argument of the liberals. The realists tend to make a rather different argument, sort of kind of with Kennan. The problem was not that Wilson was defeated, but that Wilson you know, his whole way of looking at things was kind of deeply flawed, and that was intimately related to all these problems with the Versailles Peace that led to its failure. Okay. So the historical issue has a certain theoretical resonance. Okay. How do we propose to get at this historical issue? All right. Dealing with it systematically in this lecture and in the next lecture as well. This lecture is going to try and analyze that question by looking at general policies, the general policies of the three great Western powers and of their political leaders who played such a fundamental role in shaping policy. Woodrow Wilson, the case of the United States, David Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, and Georges Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister. Right? What were their general policies, and were these the sorts of policies that could conduce to a stable international order, that could lead to a durable peace, or what? Right. So we're going to look at this stuff at the general level today, and then in the lecture on Friday, I'm going to look at it at the more specific level, issue by issue. You know, first the territorial issues, you know, the territorial issues in the East, the territorial issues in the West, then the non-territorial issues, you know, the War Guilt Clause, the reparations, the disarmament provisions, the League of Nations, all that stuff, right? So we're going to do it systematically with a view to seeing whether the Versailles Peace was in line with the basic Wilson philosophy or whether it represented the defeat of the Wilson political program. The Versailles Peace, and sum it up very briefly, the Versailles Peace was a set of constraints on German power that would keep, if German power were totally unconstrained and Germany was allowed to build up her power to whatever level she wanted, German resources were such that she would inevitably become the number one power on the continent of Europe, especially with the collapse of Russian power, all these events having to do with the Russian Revolution and so on. Russia, you know, is a cipher now in a way she hadn't been before World War I, right? The Americans withdrew, the British half withdrew, and it was just the question of relations among the powers that were on the continent, France and Germany. Well, France by herself would be no match for a resurgent Germany if Germany were allowed to recover her power. So to foreclose that danger, you needed a set of constraints on German power that would keep Germany from developing her power to the level that she was physically capable of if those constraints hadn't existed. So the Versailles system, as we'll see, and I'll talk about this, what I'm sure will strike you as kind of excruciating detail in the next lecture, the Versailles system was a set of constraints on German power to keep Germany from, again, dominating the continent of Europe. In fact, even more so than 1914. Okay. As I say, today we're going to try and see whether that type of approach was in line with the basic Wilson philosophy, the philosophy of Lloyd George, who's also a big liberal, the most important politician, represented the left in the British political spectrum before the war. And then with Clemenceau, Georges Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister. All right, so let's begin with Wilson. What sort of peace did Wilson want? Is he the great champion of a peace of reconciliation with Germany, a peace that everyone could live with, you know? Because the reconciliation of Germany, you would think, would be an essential element in a stable international order. If the Germans were deeply resentful, if they were inclined, if they could, to revolt against the treaty, if they resist the post-war system, well, that would just be a recipe for trouble. So, you know, so what was Wilson's attitude about that? Did he want reconciliation with Germany? What's the fundamental point that to take away from a reading of Wilson's wartime speeches? It's true. Before the United States entered the war, we entered the war in April of 1917, 3 months earlier, January of 1917, Wilson had given the speech, the Peace Without Victory speech, calling for a negotiated peace, a peace among equals, making the argument for a peace of reconciliation, and so on. That was before the United States entered the war. After the United States entered the war, you find this huge escalation of American war aims. Germany has to be crushed. You know, you remember that the very first speech I put in the course pack, the December 1917 speech, I think it was on the first or second page of that speech. Wilson says, this intolerable thing, you know, which the masters of Germany have shown us this faith, this thing has to absolutely be crushed. You know, and what about all these people who talk about negotiation and reconciliation and compromise and so on? They're traitors, practically. And what about the great model of the Congress of Vienna, the peace that was negotiated after the Napoleonic Wars, a peace based on these balance of power principles and so on? We don't want anything like that. This whole notion of the balance of power, it's sordid. It's the source of all of these problems that countries think in terms of balance of power instead of moral principle, right? It's as clear as can be. All you have to do is just read the text to see how dramatically Wilson's policy had changed after the United States entered into the war. Okay. What's the fundamental notion? Reconciliation? Not after America is a belligerent. That's not what should guide peacemaking, according to Wilson. The basic concept is not reconciliation, but justice. Let's have a peace based on principles of justice. If it's truly just, everyone will accept it. That's the path to stability. Okay. What's Wilson's view of war? Now that the United States is in it, war is a crime. We wouldn't have gone in unless the moral issues were clear-cut. And obviously, our side is right. The other side must be wrong. Not just wrong, but evil, a criminal country. If war is a crime, how are you supposed to deal with it? Just in the peacemaking process, ignore the fact that this enormous crime had been committed? Oh, no, the criminal nation has to be punished. If you believe in the rule of law, you can't allow the criminal to get off scot-free. That's a travesty. The criminal has to be punished. Right? Justice means punishment. Okay? Does it mean punishment forever? No. Wilson had this whole notion of how things should develop. Germany would be punished, and Germany would accept the verdict because this verdict was in line with universal principles. You know, it was obvious to Wilson Germany had caused the war. Let me talk about this a little bit, because you realize that Woodrow Wilson is the only president of the United States who had a PhD in political science. And yet he's very quick to jump to the conclusion of, we know who caused the war. The first it was Germany. It's obvious. This is before any documents had been released. And anyone with any experience in analyzing political affairs knows that you can't make those judgments without the evidence. That international politics is often a very complex thing, and kind of sorting these things out is very difficult. Even today. And you're going to be hearing a lot about this year because it's the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the war. Even today, people argue about who was responsible for the war, what caused the war, and so on. But Wilson, even before he had any evidence, it was clear to him. It had to be Germany. Why did it have to be Germany? Because if Germany wasn't a criminal, the United States wouldn't have come in. We're in, therefore, we're dealing with a criminal nation. Right? So this moralistic way of looking at things leads to those kinds of assessments. Right? So Germany had to be punished, but not forever. The Germans would accept this judgment because it was based on universal truths, you know, universal principles. In their hearts, the Germans would know that we were right. They would make penance for their crimes, And they would be subjected to what Wilson called a generation of thoughtfulness. Germany would be kept out of the League of Nations, for example, for a generation. Well, Germany made amends. Well, Germany did penance. You know, this quasi-religious overtones to this way of looking at things are not to be ignored. Okay. And after those 20 years had expired, and Germany, through her actions and her penance, had worked her way back into the community of civilized nations, then Germany would be treated as an equal. All right, that's the Wilson philosophy. All right. Now you may say, what's the evidence for this? I'm making all these claims about Wilson. This goes against, I'm sure, what you were taught, you know, in other classes in high school and so on, about this great liberal president and so on. All you have to do is look at the documents. This is documents recording Wilson's thoughts during the period of American belligerency and the immediate post-World War I period. And these are things that are, I cited them in that piece I wrote about Versailles. That's one of the optional readings, and I put it in the section for this week on the course website if you actually want to look at it. All right? At the end of the peace conference, because the peace terms are viewed as pretty harsh against Germany, the British Prime Minister, Lloyd George, gets second thoughts and says, well, maybe we should change all this stuff. And Wilson's reaction to this was very hostile. He tells Lloyd George he's not willing to change anything in the treaty because it was severe. This is in the words of the document recording these things. That he wanted this to be a historical lesson so that people might know that they could not do anything of the sort the Germans attempted without suffering the severest kind of punishment. He makes the same point in a response to a South African statesman named Schmutz, who also called for more moderate peace terms. Wilson writes him, "The treaty is undoubtedly very severe indeed. I have, of course, had an opportunity to go over each part of it as it was adopted, and I must say that though in many respects harsh, I do not think that it is on the whole unjust in the circumstances, much as I should have liked to see certain features altered. I feel the terrible responsibility of the whole business, but inevitably my thought goes back to the very great offense against civilization which the German state committed, and the necessity for making it evident once and for all that such things can lead only to the most severe punishment." Right? Punitive philosophy. Notion: justice means punishment. A moralistic approach means that the criminal nation has to be punished. How can you have the rule of law if the criminal gets off scot-free? Right? The notion of a punitive settlement is deeply rooted in the Wilsonian philosophy. Those are things he said in private. What is he saying in public? Gets back to the United States, and the Treaty of Versailles has to be ratified by the Senate, as you know, and there's opposition to it, especially certain provisions having to do with the League of Nations. And so Wilson goes on this big speaking tour to try and convince his fellow citizens that this treaty is worth ratifying. What are the arguments he makes that will lead to reconciliation, a lasting peace, and so on? No. It's the argument that Germany should be punished. And again, I'm going to read you some of these things. It's September 1919 speech. "The treaty seeks to punish one of the greatest wrongs ever done in history, the wrong which Germany sought to do to the world and to civilization, and there ought to be no weak purpose with regard to the punishment. She attempted an intolerable thing, and she must be made to pay for the attempt." And then in another speech given a couple of weeks later, "I hear that this treaty is very hard on Germany. When an individual has committed a criminal act, the punishment is hard, but the punishment is not unjust. The nation," meaning Germany, "permitted itself through unscrupulous governors to commit a criminal act against mankind, and it is to undergo the punishment." You notice, by the way, that Wilson is not distinguishing here between the imperial regime and the German nation as a whole. It's the mass of the German nation that he's holding responsible for what happened. The mere fact that the Germans changed their political system and got rid of the imperial regime at the end of the war in the hopes that this would lead to a more lenient peace, you know, as some of the things that Wilson had said had suggested, that tactic didn't work because Wilson held the entire German nation responsible, right? To a certain extent, the democratic regime that the Germans adopted at the end of the war was a mirage. It was like almost imposed on them by outside pressure because they were led to think that they would get a softer peace if they became democratic. It didn't work. And that, again, was one of the elements in the resentment that you found in Germany against the peace settlement. But the main point to take away from all this evidence is that Wilson believed in a punitive peace. Right? It's not that the punitive elements of the Treaty of Versailles directly contradicted Wilson's commitment to a peace of reconciliation, a moderate peace, a soft peace. No, he thought, you know, Germany was a criminal nation. Germany needed to be punished. Okay? What about the other major Western powers, the two European democracies, Britain and France? Well, let's begin with the British. Lloyd George was a liberal, not surprising, therefore, that he also thought in punitive terms. Plenty of evidence about this, same arguments that Wilson made. This is Wilson. This is Lloyd George in private, and this is not posturing that's adopted in public in order to mobilize, people's energies for the support of the war and so on by blackening the Germans. This is in the Imperial War Cabinet, secret, March 1917, right before the Americans come in. Lloyd George argues Germany should be punished after the war. Because, quote, the conviction must be planted in the minds of the civilized world that all wars of aggression are impossible enterprises. Men must in future be taught to shun wars. Every civilized being shuns a murder, not merely because it's wrong in itself, but because it leads to inevitable punishment. That is the only sure foundation for any league of peace. Then, August 1918, on the eve of the armistice, again, in the Imperial War Cabinet, it's secret. Lloyd George says, Germany has committed a great crime, and it was necessary to make it impossible that anyone should be tempted to repeat that offense. You know? October 1918, days before the armistice, he suggests giving the German people a real taste of war. In other words, not accepting an armistice before German territory had, in fact, been invaded. And inflicting an even more humiliating defeat on them than the one that could then be imposed. Okay, he says. He tells the British cabinet that industrial France had been devastated and Germany had escaped. At the first moment when we were in position to put the lash on Germany's back, she said, "I give up." The question arose whether we ought not to continue lashing her as she had lashed France. Then Mr. Chamberlain, this is not Neville Chamberlain of appeasement fame, but his half-brother, Austen Chamberlain, who was a leading conservative politician in the British cabinet. This is a coalition government. Austen Chamberlain says that vengeance was too expensive these days. And then Lord George's response is, it's not vengeance, but justice. All right? This is interesting because it shows you that conservatives tend to take a more moderate, more kind of almost more jaded view of these things than liberals. They are less likely to think in these moralistic terms. They're less likely to be so judgmental. More likely to think in power terms, purely political as opposed to moral terms. And it's only the further to the left you go in the British political spectrum, the more strident are the calls for the punishment of Germany. There was one member of the Labour Party in the British War Cabinet. His name was Barnes. Was furthest to the left of anyone in the in the British Cabinet at that time. And it was Barnes who called not just for the trial of the Kaiser, But for hanging the Kaiser, which is one of the big themes that the British election campaign that was conducted at the end, you know, right after the war had ended, was conducted on. All right. These are important points. They relate very directly to our issue, the issue that we're concerned with. All right, finally we have the French, Clemenceau. You look at all this punitive talk, Britain and America, and you may say, well, what do you expect? Look at the enormous bloodletting of the First World War. It was inevitable that people would be thinking in these terms, in terms of vengeance, in terms of getting back at the Germans for all the pain that they had caused. Inevitable. Here's the problem. The Americans hadn't paid nearly as high a blood price, especially in proportion to the size of their population, as France. And yet the Americans were inclined to think much more in punitive terms than the French were. If anyone was to be subject to the passions of war and to taking a vindictive line at the end of the war, you think it would be France. I should say, when I was about your age, I went on a bike trip in France with this friend of mine. And you go to these little tiny villages, and there would be this town square and a monument to the dead of the two world wars in the town square. And you see these small villages, and there'd be like 30, 40 names of young men who had died in the war of 1914, 1918, just two or three who died in the Second World War in comparison. And it's like, you know, in France was a country of 40 million people at that time. It's like 1,300,000 Frenchmen actually lost their lives in that war. This is essentially the male half of an entire generation. This is absolutely enormous. You'd think that the French would be vindictive. And in fact, a lot of historians claim that they were vindictive. But is that view borne out by the evidence? As I say, next time we're going to look at the specific issues. But this time, let's focus in on the basic thinking of the French government, the French leaders, the French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau, who's a quite extraordinary figure. Right? The war ends, as you know, in November 1918, 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918. And as soon as the war is over, people start concerning themselves with what sort of peace settlement will be worked out with Germany. And Clemenceau, he gives a speech, December 29th, 1918, to the French Parliament, French Chamber of Deputies. And, you know, Wilson had laid out his peace program, 14-point speech. Lord George, in January 1918, had given another speech laying out British demands. Clemenceau says, I'm not going to do that. I refuse to say what my peace program is going to be. And he says, why? He says, why? He says, because I need to keep my hands free. Why do I need to keep my hands free? Because we in France have this very basic political problem. Okay? We have this problem of how are we going to survive, given that Germany is inherently a stronger country than we are. Especially since the war had been fought in France and not in Germany. Right. And there had been all this devastation caused by the war in the most heavily industrialized area of France, northern France. Germans, during their retreat, had flooded the French coal mines, which were in that area, with the view to kind of crippling the French post-war economy. There were all these kind of problems. France has this problem of dealing with superior German power. How are you going to deal with it? And in principle, in a whole array of different solutions are possible. You know, you could pursue a really harsh policy, tearing off, parts of German territory, putting them under the effective control of France, giving away parts of German territory to Germany's new neighbors in the east, especially to Poland. You know, a very harsh policy vis-a-vis Germany, splitting up the German state into a number of, you know, independent smaller states, Bavaria, Prussia, and so on. On the other hand, you can pursue a very soft policy toward Germany, a policy based on true reconciliation between these nations, the deep integration of the French and the German economies, which made a lot of sense for a variety of reasons in this period, and that's one of the things I want to come back to. Pulling France and Germany together on the basis of a real accommodation of interest, true national reconciliation, right? And then there's the middle course. Germany is a problem. We're wary of Germany. We can't quite crush the German nation, but we can contain Germany. How do you contain Germany? By maintaining the alliance of the three democracies that had come into being, especially in the last year of the war. By keeping British and American troops on the continent. By maintaining the wartime coalition. That's the key to the solution. That's what this is Clemenceau's argument. And he says, and remember this quotation, is to preserve this entente, I will make any sacrifice. Okay. What about the whole Wilson program? Clemenceau was deeply skeptical. And he got into trouble at the time because he didn't quite conceal his skepticism. Why? Because Clemenceau's a realist. This whole notion of a peace based on moral principle, Clemenceau thinks this is kind of nonsense. Why? Because a world is shaped by centuries, millennia of violence and armed conflict. Who's to say, you know, what is the one and only morally acceptable way of settling things? Right? Every country has the same idea of justice. You know, things are not shaped by divine decree, right? And because countries differ among themselves about what's just, you can't just say, well, let's establish a peace based on principles of justice and everything is bound to work out okay. You have to worry about these power factors. You know, whether a country that has a different idea of justice is going to use its strength to kind of overturn the settlement, right? So you have to worry about all this stuff. This is the Clemenceau approach. But it doesn't necessarily lead to a harsh policy. There are these other elements there. And above all, the main focus of French policy is on preserving the wartime coalition and sacrificing French interests, if necessary, to do so. Right? What this means is that America is in the driver's seat. Clemenceau says, I will make these sacrifices to make sure that the Americans remain committed to the post-war settlements. Okay. Now you may say, all this stuff, it's just words. Actually, let me make one more point before I do that. Why is it that France, that had suffered so much from the war, was less vindictive than the Americans, who had suffered much less? It's not regime type. They're both great democracies. In many ways, France is more democratic than America in those days. It has to do with geopolitical positioning. The Americans can afford to indulge themselves in a moralistic foreign policy because we're so strong and so secure, weak neighbors to the north and south, great oceans to the east and west, the strongest economy by far in the world, especially at the end of the war. France, on the other hand, weaker than Germany, dependent on other powers for its political survival. You know, the French cannot indulge themselves in that same sort of approach. They are forced just to survive, to think in geopolitical terms. All right, that's one thing. The real part I want to end the lecture on this time is you get these insights by looking at policy at this general level. All these, the basic thinking, the basic concepts, and so on. You may say, all that stuff, it's just words. The real test is what they actually do on nuts and bolts issues, right? Maybe it was the case that Wilson talked in terms of a punitive peace, but wasn't he in practice much more moderate than the Europeans? Well, there's only one way to to answer that question, and that's to look at the Paris negotiations issue by issue and then reach our conclusion on that basis. So I'm going to end with that thought here, and next time, that's what we're going to pick up.